Wanna see my picture on the cover? Wanna buy 5 copies for my mother?
Yeah!
Wanna see my smiling face on the cover of the Rolling Stone?
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Rolling Stone Show here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer broadcaster, Steve Godwin, and over this next hour, I'll be reading articles about music, politics, and culture, all from Rolling Stone magazine. And tonight, as we often do, I believe we will start in the politics section. Arizona Republicans Want to Throw My Doctor in Jail, by Ava Birch. Ava Birch is a Democratic state senator here in Arizona. Last month, I had a safe, legal abortion in Arizona. Today, we are all tied up in white-knuckled knots, wondering if we're going to start throwing doctors in jail for the care they gave me. People of America, we need to talk. I am an Arizona state senator. I'm also a nurse practitioner and a mother of two. My husband and I live in Mesa, where we look after my sons, our two dogs, and a very well-fed cat. Okay, fine, we have three cats. We were not trying to get pregnant. We had two failed pregnancies in the last 2 years, and had stopped actively trying. But I wasn't on birth control either, and the discovery that I was pregnant brought on those hope-induced giggles that you try to stifle for fear of a jinx. One ultrasound after another, the disappointment set in. The pregnancy wasn't viable. Again. I had a rather nasty experience with my miscarriage in 2022, and I didn't want to go through it again. So we scheduled an abortion, and I felt very much at peace, for a moment anyway. At my first doctor's visit with Planned Parenthood, the doctor and I discussed that my pregnancy was not viable, and I shared my blood work and ultrasounds with her. In spite of this, she was required to ask me why I was having an abortion. She was required to tell me that I could consider adoption or parenting instead of abortion. She was required to tell me that if I chose to continue my pregnancy, the father would be required to provide me with financial support. She was required to give me another transvaginal ultrasound. She was required to ask me if I wanted to look at it. I stopped feeling peaceful, and another feeling crept up my stomach and through my spine and settled into the part of my brain that I normally reserve for bullies, bad drivers, and long lines. It was anger. Not anger at the medical provider, who was as much a prisoner as I was, but angry at the politicians who had clearly put laws in place to force doctors to try to coerce their patients out of having an abortion, regardless of circumstance. My abortion took place less than 3 weeks before the Arizona Supreme Court handed down its decision to uphold a complete abortion ban from 1864. The only exception it provides is if the pregnant patient is actively dying. Now, Republican legislators who have been pushing an anti-abortion agenda for decades are scrambling to backtrack in an obvious act of political desperation. At any point in time, the Arizona legislature could have repealed this ban and stopped the clock on the Supreme Court's activities. The bill to repeal the ban, sponsored by State House Representative Stephanie Stahl Hamilton, a Democrat, still sits collecting dust as Republicans dance around the issue and dream up excuses. It's an interesting conundrum for Arizona Republican lawmakers. They know that this ban is horribly unpopular and that it's going to cost them politically. They don't want to allow a Democratic bill to succeed in solving the problem, but they don't want to anger their base voters by sponsoring a solution themselves. There's also the fact that most of these Republicans are dealing with crippling cowardice against the Freedom Caucus of the Arizona legislature. This vocal minority of extremists pulls the strings on who gets challenged in the next election cycle, and they have already put out a glowing statement of support for the ban. To challenge them is to play roulette with re-election. Instead, Republican leaders are throwing out their usual nonsense, saying that Democrats want unlimited partial birth abortions on demand all the way up to the 9th month of pregnancy. Not only will you find no record of Arizona Democratic legislators ever supporting such an idea, but there are no abortion providers in this state or in this country who provide such services. It proves the Republican strategy continues to be, when you can't win, lie. There is only one solution to this abortion problem, and it lives in the November ballot box. We have to elect pro-choice candidates up and down the ticket, from the White House to the state legislatures. The facts of the day remain that this means voting for Democrats. Until the Republicans are willing to release their ransom of this issue, abortion rights will continue to erode all across the country. There seems to be only one language these politicians speak. The risk of losing power is all they will respond to, and the time to make that move is now. I will keep telling my story, consequences be damned, and I'll see you in November. Turning Point Action official resigns after election fraud allegation. By Jeremy Childs. An Arizona state legislator, 2020 election denier, and prominent leader with Turning Point Action, resigned from the organization and withdrew his campaign after allegations surfaced that he forged signatures in his re-election efforts. Austin Smith has represented Arizona House District 29 since 2023 and is a member of the Arizona House Freedom Caucus, an ultra-right group within the state legislature. He was also a senior enterprise director for Turning Point Action, the campaign arm of conservative youth activist group Turning Point USA. A lawsuit filed Monday and shared by the Arizona Republic accused Smith of using fraudulent signatures on the petition required to qualify for the Republican primary ballot. Several of Smith's petition sheets bear purported voter signatures that appear to have been written by the same person, the complaint alleged. Many of those signatures bear a striking resemblance to Smith's. Smith announced his departure Thursday in a lengthy statement posted to X/Twitter, accusing the person who filed the lawsuit as a Democrat activist who was out to get him. With no limit to the length of time that such an investigation might take and no limit to the number of billable hours I would end up paying to defend myself, those who wanted to do me real harm might well succeed, Smith said. Smith did not mention Turning Point Action in his statement, but the Washington Post reported he resigned from his position there the same day he withdrew his campaign. Turning Point Action did not immediately respond to a request for comment on Thursday night. Fellow Arizona elected official Clint Hickman, a Maricopa County supervisor and resident of Smith's district, said in a statement that he believed Smith should resign in the wake of the allegations. This is a man who has lied to the people of Legislative District 29 and the entire state about our election operations for at least 3 years, Hickman said. And now he is accused of lying about the signatures he personally collected to get on the ballot again. This is far from the first time someone who worked with Turning Point has been accused of unscrupulous behavior. Last year's America Fest conference was teeming with anti-Semitism, and a corporate sponsor of its 2023 Pastor Summit was found to be led by a registered sex offender. Republicans are determined to keep credit card late fees high. By Nikki McCann Ramirez. For all the time Republicans spend complaining about the economic struggles faced by everyday Americans, they remain steadfast in their commitment to ensuring major corporations can continue squeezing their customers. Late Wednesday afternoon, the GOP-controlled House Financial Services Committee voted to advance a bill that would repeal a new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau rule that drastically reduces the caps on credit card late fees from $30 to $41 to only $8. The legislation would also repeal the CFPB's ban on automatic adjustment of late fees due to inflation. In the Democratic-controlled Senate, where the bill is expected to fail. A similar repeal measure was introduced by Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee ranking member Tim Scott, who has recently devoted most of his energy to fawning over Donald Trump, and the bill was co-sponsored by 12 other Republicans. Credit card companies penalize consumers with exorbitant late fees that far exceed their actual costs, raking in billions of dollars in profits on the backs of those who can least afford it, said Chuck Bell, Advocacy Program Director for Consumer Reports, in a statement urging Congress to reject the repeal. He continued, "The CFPB's new late fee limits restore vital guardrails against excessive charges as Congress intended, and will greatly benefit consumers, especially families living paycheck to paycheck and doing their best to manage expenses." According to Republicans on the committee, however, lowering late fees will harm consumers by shifting costs to responsible consumers who pay on time in the form of higher annual fees and higher interest rates, while removing incentives for timely payments. An analysis published this week by the watchdog group Accountable.us found that Republicans on the committee have received over $7.9 million from industry groups against this rule and the largest credit issuers. Several of those who voted for the repeal, including Representatives Mike Lawler of New York, Zach Nunn of Iowa, and Monica De La Cruz of Texas, are facing competitive re-election races in November. The committee should put consumers poised to save billions before their industry megadonors. Big bank CEOs that boast of billion-dollar profits after nickel-and-diming Americans with junk fees don't need more special treatment from the MAGA Congress, said Liz Zelnick, Accountable.us's Director of the Economic Security and Corporate Power, in a statement ahead of the vote. In October, the White House announced a push to eliminate junk fees and increase rate transparency for consumers across various industries. The initiative includes a proposed rule that would require companies to show the full price of a product, fare, or ticket up front, and bar them from charging hidden and misleading fees. Earlier this week, the Wall Street Journal reported that the Department of Justice's Antitrust Division is preparing to file a lawsuit against entertainment giant Live Nation over their infamous use of fees to inflate ticket prices. The proposed policies are incredibly popular among consumers and incredibly unpopular amongst Republicans hell-bent on denying Biden any victory in an election year. In February, Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican of Georgia, came out against a Biden administration proposal to eliminate airline seat selection fees for families with children. What's next? Joe Biden using his power as president to demand kids eat free at all restaurants too? Why don't you do your job and close the border instead of pandering for votes? Greene wrote on X, formerly Twitter. If Republicans want to brand themselves as the pro-junk fee party to stick it to Joe Biden, they're welcome to do so. "They've taken away my right to speak," Trump says while ranting to reporters. By Nikki McCann Ramirez. Donald Trump claimed on Friday that he has been stripped of his constitutional right to speak to the press while ranting to a giant gaggle of reporters. The former president took time before entering court in his criminal hush money trial to once again complain about a gag order barring him from attacking witnesses, prosecutors, court staff, and jurors involved in the case. "The gag order has to come off. People are allowed to speak about me, and I have a gag order," Trump said. "They are taking away my constitutional rights to speak, and that includes speaking to you. I have a lot to say to you, and I am not allowed to say it. But I am the only one. Everyone else can say whatever they want about me. They can say anything they want. They can continue to make up lies. But I am not allowed to speak. I want to speak to the press and everybody else about it. So why am I gagged?" Trump has, in fact, been speaking loudly to everyone. The former president rails about the case to the press multiple times a day when entering and exiting the courtroom, and has also been posting his thoughts on the trial with his characteristic barrages of commentary on Truth Social. On Friday, Trump spent the morning ranting on Truth Social about why he deserved widespread presidential immunity from alleged crimes committed while president, a proposal the Supreme Court is slated to hear oral arguments on next week, and which could have profound effects on the various criminal cases against Trump. If a president doesn't have immunity, he or she will be nothing more than a ceremonial president, rarely having the courage to do what has to be done for our country. This is not what the founders had in mind. Protect presidential immunity. Make America great again, he wrote. What Trump is not allowed to do is use his public statements to attempt to influence, intimidate, or attack those involved in the trial, a standard ask of criminal defendants. But even those minimal restrictions are proving difficult for the former president to manage. On Monday, prosecutors requested that Trump be punished for allegedly violating a gag order, barring him from attacking witnesses, prosecutors, court staff, and jurors involved in the case. On Thursday, they requested that Judge Mershon consider an additional 7 alleged violations of the order in a hearing scheduled for next week. Prosecutors pointed to several social media posts in which Trump attacked the juror selection process. In one post, Trump quoted Fox News host Jesse Waters, who claimed, "They are catching undercover liberal activists lying to the judge in order to get on the Trump jury." Trump's actions during the ongoing jury selection process have even led to a reprimand from Judge Juan Mershon. On Tuesday, Mershon sharply admonished Trump and his team after the former president was heard muttering commentary during the questioning of potential jurors. "I will not have any jurors intimidated in this courtroom. I want to make that crystal clear," Mershon said. 12 jurors have been selected, and the search continues for the 6 alternates that will fill out the final roster. However, the scrutiny placed on potential jurors has already affected some prospective participants' willingness to sit for the trial. On Thursday, one juror who had been selected for the trial requested to be excused, citing concerns about the amount of identifying details about her being reported in the press and the potential of being identified publicly. Yet, for all of Trump's complaining and commentary about the trial and jury selection, the former president can't seem to actually stay engaged in the proceedings. Maggie Haberman of the New York Times reported on Monday that he was dozing off during the proceedings, and then noted that he did so again on Friday. Trump also reportedly fell asleep on Tuesday and Thursday. Hamas arms maker and serial fraudster gets 70 years in prison for torture, by Zach Coplin. In a secret recording produced at trial, Ross Roggio, an international arms dealer and con artist from Pennsylvania, spat defiance towards the federal agents investigating him. "They can fucking arrest me and torture me till the day they die," he said. The federal prison system is about to get a chance to do just that. Roggio, 55, was convicted of money laundering, wire fraud, arms smuggling, and torture last May. On Monday, he was sentenced by a federal judge to serve 70 years in prison, effectively a life sentence. A serial fraudster, according to federal prosecutors, Roggio's schemes were profiled in depth by Rolling Stone last year. He shook down Haitian earthquake victims and duped U.S. Special Forces veterans, but his crowning achievement and downfall was conning Polad Talabani, a Kurdish counter-terrorism official who had contracted him to build an illegal weapons factory in Sulaymaniyah, Iraq. Weapons made at Roggio's factory ended up in the hands of militant groups, including Hamas. Roggio convinced Talabani, whose brother Lahore was then co-president and intelligence chief of the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, or PUK, the party that rules Sulaymaniyah, that he could deliver a factory that produced thousands of M4 rifles and Glock-style pistols. He was given command of a company of Kurdish soldiers, and Talabani's associates funneled him tens of millions of dollars. By 2016, in a warehouse located near the PUK headquarters of Kala Shwalan, a village north of Sulaymaniyah, Raggio was producing prototype weapons. But according to federal prosecutors, Raggio was secretly purchasing sub-quality machines for the project that were incapable of manufacturing the type and number of weapons promised. Instead, Raggio, who was on an annual salary of $1.4 million, embezzled millions more from the project to buy sports cars and Rolex watches. When Raggio began feeling pressure from Kurdish officials to start showing results, he elected to export from the United States to Iraq components that were essential to mass-producing these weapons, prosecutors wrote in a sentencing memo. But he had another problem. Raggio believed that one of his employees, an Estonian named Sim Sar, might tell his Kurdish bosses that he was stealing from them. Using the soldiers under his command, Raggio abducted Sar and for 39 days held him on the site of a shuttered U.S. State Department facility in Sulaymaniyah and tortured him. Kurdish officials still trusted Raggio, were unaware of the fraud, and believed Raggio when he said Sar had been misbehaving and needed to be taught a lesson, prosecutors said. Raggio led interrogations where soldiers choked, beat, and tased Sar until he bled. In legal documents, Raggio claimed the taser contained very little force. But Sar and his colleagues were deeply traumatized. Raggio bragged on secret recordings that what he did to Sar showed the overwhelming ability of mine to crush somebody. Cody McBride, a former U.S. government interrogator who served as an expert witness for prosecutors during Raggio's trial and spoke about it on the Trap Draw podcast, said Raggio tried to suggest his Kurdish torture facility was a CIA black site and he tortured Sar on orders from the agency. Raggio's lawyer was trying to give the impression that he's not Jason Bourne, but he's like a guy that would help Jason Bourne, said McBride. Raggio falsely told FBI and Homeland Security investigations agents that he had been working for the CIA in Kurdistan, prosecutors said in a sentencing memo. Neither torture nor fake CIA connections were enough to conceal Raggio's embezzling forever. Auditors just showed up, Raggio texted Talabani in November 2016. LOL. The Kurds accused Raggio of stealing $4 million. Raggio was put under house arrest in Sulaymaniyah. Without Raggio stealing from it, the factory project got back on track. Weapons were manufactured and sold on the Iraqi and Syrian black markets under two ghost brands, Delta Defense Group and Eagle Firearms. Some of these weapons have found their way into the hands of militant groups, including Kurdish groups like the Kurdistan Workers' Party and the Kurdistan Free Life Party, both sanctioned as terrorist organizations by the U.S. Department of the Treasury. Other weapons ended up in the hands of Hamas, the Palestinian militant group that broke out of Gaza on October 7th, killing nearly 700 civilians. A photo of Hamas deputy chairman Saleh al-Aruri, shortly before he was assassinated by Israel in Beirut in January, shows him posing with a Delta Defense rifle. Thanks to Raggio's factory, thousands of guns spread throughout Middle Eastern war zones. Production only stopped after the factory was seized by Talabani's political rivals in 2021. While the guns contributed to regional instability, Raggio himself was causing chaos in Sulaymaniyah. Without repaying the Kurds, he made a successful bid for freedom escaping house arrest by climbing out of the window of his penthouse apartment and scaling the building before escaping the city and later Iraqi Kurdistan. Back in the United States, Raggio was indicted in March 2018. He's only the second American ever to be convicted for torture. We are pleased that someone who committed horrible crimes in our country has been served his due punishment, a Kurdish government official told Rolling Stone. He left a trail of pain behind him. I think it was fair, Sarr says about the sentence, in an email to Rolling Stone. Mr. Raggio, to this day, does not seem to understand what exactly he did and won't take responsibility for it. Raggio's defining characteristic is his willingness to sacrifice others to serve his own interests, prosecutors said. And now, for the rest of his life, Raggio is going to pay for his actions himself. You're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, a public service of Rio Salado College. And this hour we're reading Rolling Stone magazine. Let's go now to the music section. Remy Wolf doesn't just want you to hear her world. She wants you to taste, touch, and smell it. That could be dangerous. By Larisha Paul. Remy Wolf's eyes are scanning the immediate area surrounding the metal table we've claimed on a side street in New York's Chinatown. Fuck, there's no wood, she says, swiveling her head around once more before finding what she's looking for. About 6 feet away, outside of a barber shop, sit two wooden chairs, and, as she sees it, the key to continuing her streak of good luck, or at least warding off any potential bad fortune. I've developed a knocking on wood tick, she explains, after jogging over to double-tap her fist against the seat. Another friend of mine has it. Maybe I caught it from him. Wolf 28 has too many stars aligning in this present moment to take any chances. A few weeks after we talk, in March, she'll embark on a 2-month tour, opening for Olivia Rodrigo in Europe, following up recent stints with Paramore and Lorde. Then comes the big one, or rather, Big Ideas, her sophomore studio album, set for release on July 12th. For more than a year, Wolf split her time between the stage, the studio, and her home in Los Angeles, settling comfortably into an insular creative cycle as she crafted the follow-up to 2021's Juno, the lyrically unpredictable debut LP that marked her as one of the quirkiest, catchiest artists in alt-pop. Now she's reacquainting herself with an entirely different routine. I made this record, did all my writing, and now here comes the other half of the job. Going out and having to look good, she says. I just try to do whatever I would do naturally, but at a certain point, when you're constantly being perceived, I don't really know how it's affecting my psyche. Wolf noticed some signs of how all the attention was changing her in 2022, and she didn't like what she saw. I went through this big period where I had so much anxiety, she recalls. I couldn't leave my house. I hated seeing anybody I knew or anybody that knew me. I was deeply just like, I can't handle the thought of people using me or wanting something from me. I hate the idea of hidden intentions, and it's kind of always happening. Keeping a tight-knit group of friends has helped minimize that problem, she says. Big Ideas sees the return of Wolf's longtime producer, Jared Solomon, whom she's known since she was 15. Her drummer, Connor Malloy, is another main character in the cast of her life. They met while she was attending the USC Thornton School of Music and living in a cockroach-ridden house with nearly a dozen people in the mid-2010s. Wolf holds a particular fondness for the people who knew her during that time, when the parties she threw and the songs she penned alone in her room were more instrumental to her education than her actual coursework. I was a bad student, and I didn't listen or go to class, Wolf admits. I mean, I did go to some classes, but a lot of the classes where it was like, let me teach you the right way to do this, I was just sleeping through. Her brand of pop music, accordingly, veers far away from the melodic math of someone like Max Martin. Her verses are often sprawling and hyper-specific, like leaked messages from a group chat of close friends. And her melodies will at times take on three different shapes within a single chorus. Where many pop traditionalists would push for polished storylines and pristine production, Wolf prefers distorted synths and metaphors that liken chaotic relationships to making buttermilk from scratch. One second we're good, then it's overkill. She credits TikTok with making her more of a pop consumer in recent months. I think TikTok has gotten me into the Ariana Grande album, she notes. Eternal Sunshine was co-produced by Martin. And there is one place where she and someone like the veteran super producer overlap. I am a stickler for syllabic ease, Wolf adds. I'd rather say a word that feels good than say a word that makes sense. When Wolf was growing up in California, her mom often played Prince and other giants of 80s pop. Her father, meanwhile, leaned towards acts like AC/DC and Guns N' Roses. Once she was old enough to pick out her own records, the first album she sprang for was Lindsay Lohan's 2004 debut album, Speak. Wolf took a newly soulful approach to big ideas, which was largely recorded with vintage equipment at Diamond Mine and Electric Lady Studios in New York. There's a horn section on the single Cinderella, plus the same Rhodes that Stevie Wonder played in the 70s. Elsewhere on the album, you'll find tracks that are pure synth-funk magic, and others with viscerally transportive sensory detailing, all burning rubber, chlorine, and tangerines. Wolf doesn't just want you to hear her world. She wants you to taste, touch, and smell it, too. I'm truly trying to describe what I was experiencing, she says. We live in a world where we're eating and kissing and touching and smelling. The songs themselves usually take shape, at least on paper, over the course of 1 to 5 hours. The events that inspire them tend to be much longer. I tried to not paint any pictures that are at all far from the truth, Wolf says. In that way, I don't feel like I am directing the characters. I feel like the characters are directing me. And the people in my life are influencing what I do, what I write about, where I'm hanging out, where I'm going to dinner. On one highlight from the new album, Wolf narrates a real-life solo trip to Art Basel, where she was invited to attend a Playboy party. It's like there's cocaine everywhere, and I'm out there meeting people that I've never met before and making new friends, she says. But it's all under this kind of psychotic, manic, cocaine fever dream. Wolf has been partying since she was 18 and feels as though she's mostly gotten it out of her system in the past decade. There's still a beast inside me that wants to rage, but it's more tame now, she says with a laugh. Much of her debut album circled the boundaries of sobriety, particularly from alcohol. Those lines are still blurring for her, especially in social settings. I hate feeling like I'm somewhere and I cannot participate in what is happening, Wolf says. There's times when I drink and I feel like shit. There's times when I'm sober and I feel like shit. I'm trying to figure out how to not feel like shit in both areas. She recognizes it as a non-linear process, adding, if you struggled with it, it's going to be a struggle for life no matter what direction you go in. Incorporating consistent routines into her day-to-day has helped Wolf feel more present, both physically and emotionally. When we speak, she's been in New York for 4 days and hasn't yet been able to complete all three of her daily target goals, go on a 2-hour walk, go to yoga, and grab a cup of coffee. It's hard to feel grounded when you're having to think about your feelings all the time, she says. Even going to yoga alone was something she initially had to pep talk herself through. My job is to know and understand myself. It's an amazing pursuit, but it's an exhausting pursuit, she adds. Sometimes I just don't want to fucking think about myself. John Oates is pretty sure that Hall and Oates are never, ever getting back together. By Andy Green. When John Oates spoke to Rolling Stone in January 2020, he explained how balancing his time between massive Hall & Oates concerts with his longtime creative partner Daryl Hall and intimate solo gigs provided him with a dream life. "It keeps me balanced," he said. "When I tour solo, I carry my own gear. I show up with my guitar in hand and put the amp in the back of my car. It's real, and I love it. Then I go out there with Daryl, and we're flying around in private planes and playing the garden and doing all that. I love it." It was, therefore, a pretty big shock when, in November 2023, Hall accused Oates of committing the ultimate partnership betrayal by attempting to sell his share of their business without his permission in a legal filing that generated headlines all across the globe. They haven't played a show together since October 2022. "I am deeply troubled by the deterioration of my relationship with and trust in John Oates," Hall told the court. "His behavior has become adversarial and aggressive instead of professional and courteous." Oates wasn't willing to discuss details of the ongoing legal battle when he spoke with Rolling Stone recently about his new solo LP reunion. But he did explain why his attitude toward Hall & Oates shifted so dramatically. "I'll tell you what changed," he says. "During the pandemic, there were no more private planes. There were no more arena shows or even acoustic shows. And it gave me a chance to step back. I had a chance to reevaluate things. My wife and I decided it was time to give back. We started the Oates Songfest for Feeding America, and we fed 350,000 families with that. And then I was asked to do Movember, which was a men's health movement. I just got out of the mode of getting back on stage with the big band and the big production." That big Hall & Oates production was at the center of his life for more than 50 years. He's delivered hits like Maneater, Private Eyes, and Kiss on My List alongside Hall well over 1,000 times each. "I understand why people come and want to hear the big hits," he says. "Those songs are going to live forever. But I wanted to relegate them to the classic file that they're in, and I wanted them to be heard in the best possible light, the way they were when the spark was on fire in the 70s and 80s. That's when those songs really resonated. To keep playing them, for me, was no longer interesting. I just wanted to do something else." In his perfect world, the business dispute with Hall, what Oates calls a very boring business issue, would never have become public. "There's always disputes when people are famous. People are always fascinated about the dynamics of a duo," he says. "And to be quite honest, Daryl and I have a business partnership, and there were some things about the business that we disagreed with, which happens all the time in business. And we're going to work it out." A rep for Hall did not respond to Rolling Stone's request for comment. Last year, Hall played a series of dates with Todd Rundgren. At the end of the night, they sang each other's songs together, including the Hall & Oates 1979 classic, Wait for Me. The lawsuit hit right before he flew out to begin a new leg of the tour in Asia, and Hall accused Oates of trying to sabotage the tour. "This recent bad faith conduct by John Oates and the Oates Trust has created tremendous upheaval, harm, and difficulty in my life," Hall wrote in a legal filing. "I believe that John Oates timed the unauthorized transaction to create the most harm to me." Oates says this is untrue. "That's what he said?" Oates asks. "I didn't even know he was going on tour. I had nothing to do with that." "If that's how he perceived it, then that's how he perceived it. But really, honestly, I don't follow him on social media. In fact, I don't even know what he's doing. I hope he's doing well, and I hope he's having a time of his life, but it's not part of my life." According to Oates, he was also unaware that Hall was touring America with Elvis Costello later this year, until Rolling Stone informed him of that news. "I'm really glad that, in a way, this situation has given him the opportunity to be himself," Oates says. And however he wants to show himself and perform and be creative as an individual, I think it's great, because that's what I want to do. Despite all the current drama, Hall & Oates never formally broke up. They just stopped booking concert dates. And Wikipedia lists the duo's active years as 1970 to present. Should an official end date be added to the career of one of the most successful pop duos of all time? Well, you can ask Daryl the same question, Oates says. But yes, as far as I'm concerned, I've moved on. I feel like I have a new lease on my creative life. He then picks up a book and begins reading a passage. I'm basically a Taoist, he says, and I'm going to read you something that was in my daily meditation today. It says, "The rule for those who follow Tao is this. Walk the path together as long as you can, and when you must part, never hold your companion back." Well, that's how I feel about things, he continues. A good friend of mine said something to me when this was all starting. He said, "John, you were a musician before you met Daryl, and you're still a musician. You're an individual." And Daryl and I have always called ourselves Daryl Hall and John Oates because we always wanted to be perceived as two individuals who work together. That was very important to us. If you look at the albums, you'll see that on every album. And so this is the ultimate expression of that. However, Hall and Oates were also best friends. They even lived in an apartment together. The name of the group came from what their landlord scribbled on their mailbox, Hall and Oates. While they may never play together again, Oates doesn't rule out repairing their friendship. "I'm always open for that," he says. "Daryl Hall is an amazing individual. He's one of the great, great songwriters of all time, and without a doubt, one of the great singers of all time. I'd never say anything negative about him. But we have a different strategy for our lives, and we have a different strategy for our business lives, as well as our personal lives. And that's that. So be it. We're old guys. We deserve to be allowed to do whatever we want to do." Does he hope those old guys can one day perform one last song together to end the story on a positive note? "I have no idea," he says. "But I don't see it. I really don't. Life's funny, though. You never know what kind of curve it will throw you." This is Sun Sounds of Arizona, a public service of Rio Salado College. We're reading Rolling Stone magazine this hour. And now I'm going to flip over to the subculture section and see what we can find there. Hype and magical thinking. The AI healthcare boom is here. By Miles Clay. Artificial intelligence tech has infiltrated every industry, and healthcare is no exception. We now have Together by Renee, an app that tracks your medical history, aims to gauge your blood pressure with a selfie, and detect depression or anxiety symptoms by the sound of your voice. Drug GPT, developed at Oxford University, is a tool designed to help doctors prescribe medications and keep patients informed about what they're taking. You can download Humanity, a generative AI health coach that promises to reduce biological age. And Google is working on a machine learning model that will potentially diagnose a patient based on the sound of their cough. But the potential consequences of these applications are somewhat different than what may happen when you use AI to create a song. To put it in the starkest terms, lives are at risk. And experts in the fields of health and technology tell Rolling Stone that they have real doubts about whether these innovations can serve the public good. For Bernard Robertson Dunn, an experienced systems engineer who serves as chair of the Health Committee at the Australian Privacy Foundation, one major issue is that developers themselves have handled patient information all wrong from the very start. Decades ago, he says, there was a big push for digitizing medical records, but the promise of this revolution fell through because technologists think these data are like financial transaction data. They aren't, Robertson Dunn says. Financial transaction data are facts, and the meaning of an existing transaction does not change over time. If you look at your bank account, it will not have changed for no apparent reason. Health data, meanwhile, can change from day to day without you knowing it and why. You might catch COVID, HIV, a cold, or have a heart attack today, which invalidates a lot of your health record data as recorded yesterday, says Robertson Dunn. In his view, the old frenzy for electronic health records has carried over to the AI boom, which is a far bigger problem. I'm never going to say that technology is harmful or we shouldn't use it, says Julia Stoyanovich, the computer scientist who leads New York University's Center for Responsible AI. But in this particular case, I have to say that I'm skeptical, because what we're seeing is that people are just rushing to use generative AI for all kinds of applications simply because it's out there, and it looks cool, and competitors are using it. She sees the AI rush emerging from hype and magical thinking, and that people really want to believe there's something out there that is going to do the impossible. Stoyanovich and Robertson Dunn both point out that AI health tools are currently evading the kinds of clinical trials and regulation that are necessary to bring a medical device to market. Stoyanovich describes a loophole that makes this possible. It's not really the tool that's going to prescribe a medicine to you. It's always a tool that a doctor uses, and ultimately the doctor's going to say, yes, I agree, or I disagree. And this is why these tools are escaping scrutiny that one would expect a tool to have in the medical domain. But it's problematic still, right? Stoyanovich adds. Because we know that humans, doctors are no exception, would rely on these tools too much. Because if a tool gives you an answer that seems precise, then a human is going to say, well, who am I to question it? Worse, she says, a bot could cite an article in a journal like Science or The Lancet to support its conclusion, even if the research directly contradicts it. Elaine O. Nasozi, a data scientist at the Boston University School of Public Health, who researches how tech can advance health equity, explains what a diagnostic AI model could be missing when it assesses a patient's symptoms. These tools basically learn all this information and then they give it back to you, and it lacks context and it lacks nuance, she says. If a patient comes in, they might have specific symptoms, and maybe they have a history of different conditions, and the doctor might be able to provide medical advice that might not be standard or what the data that has been used to train our algorithm would produce. According to Nasozi, artificial intelligence can also replicate or exacerbate the systemic health inequities that adversely affect women, people of color, LGBTQ patients, and other disadvantaged groups. When you see algorithms not doing what you're supposed to do, the problem usually starts with the data, she says. When you look at the data, you start to see that either certain groups are not being represented or not represented in a way that is equitable. So there are biases, maybe stereotypes attached to the models. There's racism or sexism. She has co-authored a paper on the topic, In Medicine, How Do We Machine Learn Anything Real? It outlines how a long history of discrimination in healthcare spaces has produced biased data, which, if used in naive applications, can create malfunctioning systems. Still, Nasozi and others are cautiously optimistic that AI can benefit public health, just maybe not in the ways that companies are pursuing at the moment. When it comes to using various forms of AI for direct patient care, the details of implementation will matter a lot, says Nate Sheridan, a fellow at the Center for AI Safety. It's easy to imagine doctors using various AI tools in a way that frees up their time to spend it with their patients face-to-face. Transcription comes to mind, but so do medical records summarization and initial intake. Doctors have been indicating that their inability to spend meaningful time with their patients is a problem for decades, and it's leading to burnout across the profession, exacerbated, of course, by COVID-19. Sheridan sees the potential risks as well, however, including private for-profit long-term care facilities cutting corners on staff by attempting to automate things with AI, or charlatans selling the AI equivalent of useless supplements. He identifies the Together app as one example. There's absolutely no way they are accurately detecting SpO2, that's blood oxygen levels, with a selfie, he says. I'm sure that they and other businesses will be careful to indicate that their products are not intended to diagnose or treat any disease. This is the typical FDA-compliant label for selling something that people don't actually need, that doesn't actually work. Stoyanovich agrees with Sheridan that we need to think hard about what exactly we want from this technology, or what gap we're hoping these tools will fill in the field of medicine. These are not games. This is people's health and people's trust in the medical system. A major vulnerability on that end is the privacy of your health data. Whether or not AI models like Google's cough analyzing tool can work reliably, Stoyanovich says they are sucking in a lot of information from us, and medical data is especially sensitive. She imagines a future in which health insurance companies systematically raise premiums for customers based on information captured by such apps. They're going to be using this data to make decisions that will then impact people's access to medical care, Stoyanovich predicts, comparing the situation to the irresponsible and arbitrary use of AI in hiring and employment. It ends up disadvantaging people who have been disadvantaged historically. Stoyanovich worries, too, that exaggerating the effectiveness of AI models in a clinical setting because of a few promising results will lead us down a dangerous path. We've seen a lot of excitement from specific cases being reported that, let's say, ChatGPT was able to diagnose a condition that several doctors missed and were unable to diagnose right, Stoyanovich says. And that makes it so that we now believe that ChatGPT is a doctor. But when we judge whether somebody is a good doctor, we don't look at how many cases they've had right. We look at how many cases they got wrong. We should, at the very least, be holding these machines to a similar standard, but being impressed with a doctor who diagnosed one specific difficult case, that's silly. We actually need to have robust evaluation that works in every case. The tech and health experts who spoke to Rolling Stone largely concur that having medical professionals double-check the output of AI models adds a layer of tedium and inefficiency to healthcare. Robertson Dunn says that in the case of pathology tests, like those involving the reading of x-rays or MRI scans, a qualified medic can assess the AI diagnosis of each one, but that turns the job of a highly skilled practitioner into a very boring, soul-destroying mechanical routine. And as Nassosi observes, perhaps we can entirely reframe the opportunity AI poses in healthcare. Instead of trying to measure the biological qualities of individuals with machines, we might deploy those models to learn something about entire regions and communities. Nassosi says that the AI movement in Africa has come up with promising solutions that include using AI for monitoring air pollution that impacts health. Being able to collect that data and process it and make use of it for policymaking is quite important, she says. Where it comes to public health, Nassosi says, the focus should be on addressing the root causes of illness and health inequities rather than just fixing the symptoms of it. It would be better, in her view, to leverage AI tech to answer questions of why we have particular populations with bigger rates of diabetes or cancer, instead of designing an app that targets people with those conditions. The ideal solutions, she adds, require talking to patients and the clinicians serving them to find out what they really need, and letting their input guide the development process. App developers, Nassosi says, are typically not doing that research or soliciting feedback. That's just more effective, she concludes, but it requires that you actually prioritize people rather than money. Tesla ordered to recall Cybertrucks over accelerator crash risk, by Nikki McCann Ramirez. Tesla's stock crashed this week following the announcement that the electric vehicle company would be laying off 10% of its staff. If things weren't already looking grim for Elon Musk's flagship company, it was just ordered to recall nearly 4,000 of its recently released Cybertrucks over an accelerator pedal issue that could result in actual crashes. On Friday, the National Highway Safety Traffic Administration, or NHTSA, issued a mandatory recall of 3,878 Cybertrucks, the futuristic stainless steel beasts that have become the subject of widespread public mockery and consumer disappointment since its launch late last year. The NHTSA wrote in their recall notice that when high force is applied to the pad on the Cybertruck accelerator pedal, the pad may dislodge, which may cause the pedal to become trapped in the interior trim above the pedal, an issue which may increase the risk of a collision. Earlier this week, Tesla paused the production, sale, and delivery of the trucks with little explanation. One TikTok user posted a video theorizing that the pause may be due to pedal malfunctions and described how the accelerator cover on his own Cybertruck had slipped off the pedal and become jammed in the vehicle's floorboard. It held the accelerator down 100% full throttle, user at El Chapito said. Luckily, I had a clear mind, didn't panic. Holding the brake down overrides the accelerator, so I was able to stop the car, but any time I'd lift the brake, it would start accelerating again. You know, when we first saw the Cybertruck, I think more than a few of us thought that maybe Elon's pad had slipped off the pedal, if you get my drift. Okay, that's it for tonight. You've been listening to selected articles from the online edition of Rolling Stone magazine. Once again, my name is Steve Godwin, and it's been my pleasure to read them for you. And this is Sun Sounds of Arizona, a public service of Rio Salado College.